Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting the film series Testigo Witness, Goya in the Movies. Held on select Fridays in May, each film touches upon artist Francisco de Goya's visions of the world, kicking off with Pan's Labyrinth by Guillermo del Toro on May 10th at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a spring super sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceling a visit to Washington by a high-level delegation to protest this morning's UN Security Council decision calling for an immediate ceasefire. The resolution passed just a couple of hours ago, 14-0, after the U.S. abstained from the voting. It, of course, could have vetoed it, as the U.S. had done with previous Security Council resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Netanyahu accused the U.S. of retreating from what he said had been a principled position by allowing the vote to pass without conditioning the ceasefire on the release of hostages held by Hamas. The Israeli delegation was to present White House officials with plans for an expected ground invasion of the southern Gaza town of Rafah, where over a million Palestinian civilians have sought shelter from the war. Joining us to talk about the very latest developments on Gaza today is Julian Borger, World Affairs Editor for The Guardian. Julian is based in Washington, D.C. Julian, very good to have you with us. How surprising was it to have the U.S. abstain in that Security Council vote this morning?
Quite surprising, because at the end of last week, when the U.S. resolution that tied a ceasefire to hostage release, when that was vetoed by Russia and China, the U.S. mission made it clear that anything that didn't condemn Hamas or didn't link the ceasefire with the release of hostages would not make it. And so this is a shift over the weekend. They've been debating the language. There were some changes in language, but ultimately it is a U.S. Shift to accept a resolution that A, doesn't make the ceasefire conditional on hostage release, and B, doesn't include a direct condemnation of Hamas for its 7th of October attack.
We've seen, of course, somewhat of a shift in the U.S. position through statements made by Secretary of State Blinken and even by President Biden himself. But what is what's the speculation about the message the U.S. is delivering to Israel with this abstention?
The message is they're losing their patience. Israel is ignoring them on two fronts, principally. Benjamin Netanyahu keeps on saying that he's intent on going ahead of a Rafah offensive in the face of very clear U.S. opposition, and B, that the maybe more urgent and more important is Israel continuing to hinder the delivery of humanitarian aid, particularly to northern Gaza, where the UN panel of experts have said that a famine is imminent. So there's this feeling of a ticking clock that we could have a really humanitarian disaster of historic proportions on our hand if the international community does not act faster and put more pressure on Israel.
And now that we have Netanyahu saying that this high-level delegation that was going to be holding a series of meetings, including with the head of the CIA and with the Secretary of State and others, that is now canceled. Where do we sit now today with this, with the expression by Washington, with its abstention, and now with the angry response of Netanyahu? What comes next?
Well, this is the most significant rift between an open rift between the Biden administration and Netanyahu since the war began. It's come out into the open in a very direct way. And, you know, although this delegation of two ministers in particular has been cancelled, the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, is in Washington and is due to meet the defense secretary. So it's not, you know, the end of contacts.
Oh, so that meeting is still being held. Okay. I'd assumed that was part of the others that were being canceled.
That was this is being treated as separate meeting between the defense leaders. But what may help this situation is that there are noises coming out from Hamas and the Hamas leadership abroad that in the negotiations going on in Doha, they will be more open to a deal that involves the release of hostages in the wake of this UN resolution. They're saying they frame it as we now call for a prisoner swap, which is the way they tend to frame their announcements on this. But they are sending signs that maybe it'll be easier to do a hostage for a ceasefire deal in Doha. And those talks are still going on, and they've been going on over the weekend.
We're talking with Julian Borger of The Guardian. He's based in D.C. and World Affairs editor. Speaking of those Qatar-convened talks in Doha, we had word from multiple publications within the past few days that Israel and the U.S. had agreed on what the formula would be for the number of prisoners Israel is holding, for the number of Israeli prisoners that are being held by Hamas. Have we gotten any specifics on what that formula is?
The last that I've heard is there is a formula that links the number of female IDF soldiers that will be among this initial tranche of 40 hostages to be released, characterized as being among the more vulnerable hostages, and that there is a rate of exchange that is being debated now and been debated over the weekend. But the latest we've heard is that the Israeli offer of the number of Palestinian prisoners and detainees that it will release has gone up from about 400 to about 700. So, and we've also heard, and this is mainly through Israeli reporting, that the Israelis are being more flexible and when it comes to the return of displaced Palestinians to northern Gaza. It's something that they weren't countenancing before, but now they're talking about at least a limited return. And that was an important demand put forward by Hamas on the table.
And do we know about the delay in Hamas responding to this offer? Is this just logistical, a matter of communicating between Doha and Gaza, or do we know what kinds of rifts there might be within Hamas leadership over what to accept or not?
We don't know, but we do know that obviously it is hard for them to communicate. Yahya Sinwar, the leader in Gaza, who is now, there's no question, calling the shots, he is somewhere, we presume, underground, in Gaza, and there is a lag in terms of getting messages out to the leadership that is represented in Doha. So we know that that is an issue. Whether on top of that there are disagreements on what to settle for, that's also quite plausible. We just don't know the sort of how much is one, how much is the other.
This ceasefire, I know within the language that the Security Council passed, mentions Ramadan and this period, holy period for Muslims. Is this tied to the end of Ramadan that the ceasefire would then potentially end, or has that been spelled out?
Yeah, what it says is that it demands an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan. So we are sort of in the midst of that. Respected by all parties, it says. And then it says, leading to a lasting, sustainable ceasefire. The original wording said leading to a permanent, sustainable ceasefire. the US got that change to lasting. These are sort of, you know, these small diplomatic battles that are fought. But what the resolution suggests is that Ramadan should only be the beginning of it. That initially Ramadan is the reason for having a ceasefire, but that it should lead to something broader and more lasting.
And what happens in terms of international response if Israel violates this and moves forward with military action in Rafah?
Well, as the U.S. envoy to the U.N. made clear, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, that it is a non-binding resolution. It's not as if the U.N. is going to send in troops, but this is a matter of international reputation, the fact that they would be going against a U.N. resolution passed 14-0, demanding a ceasefire. That would just put them further at odds with the international community. So it's about reputation, but the relationship that matters to them most and is most important, of course, is this relationship with the US and with the White House. And the question is, if they went ahead with Rafah, or they ignored the appeals to open those gates to more humanitarian aid, at what point does President Biden use the leverage that he has at his fingertips, which is to start limiting the flow of weapons? And that is really the key question that is at the heart of this diplomatic maneuvering.
Julian Borger, thank you very much. Good to talk with you today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
World Affairs editor for The Guardian. He's based in D.C.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubrias, The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you again for your support for keeping Air Talk strong on LAist 89.3. Our LAist science reporter, Jacob Margolis, always so fun to talk with him. And in fact, Jacob, I saw your dad on television this morning talking about his business manufacturing eclipse glasses. It was fun to see him.
Yeah, it's wild. I grew up, he manufactures eclipse glasses and 3D glasses and glasses that you look at fireworks and you see rainbows all over the sky. So it was a trippy childhood in Reseda.
I'll sure. bet, definitely. Well, and we're looking forward to talking with your father sometime before this total eclipse that is upcoming for part of the country. And you're going to be traveling, I know, and have a chance to see it. So that'll be
great. We've traveled our whole lives for eclipses, and it's, I think, our last American eclipse likely for quite some time. I think the next one's 2044. So anyone that has a chance to watch this one, I would say, you know, go watch. It's always, people always downplay it before, and then when it's happening, people just, they trip out and they have a great time. And so it's absolutely going to be a blast.
With the last one that we had, our former senior producer, she'd since retired, but she was traveling to an area of totality. And so, and it happened as we were on the air live. So she was describing it, doing play by play. And you could just tell how everybody was just awestruck. Can you describe what it's like to see it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, So seeing it is like seeing it in photos and videos and whatnot, but the vibe of what is going on of how is very unique. And so all of a sudden, you know, everything turns dark, you know, birds kind of quiet down, and it gets very chilly, and you're, you know, everyone is just looking to the sky and experiencing this wonderful, unique event. And, you know, what's really interesting, what's been interesting about traveling around, getting to travel around the world with different people and see this is the reactions are the same kind of everywhere that I've had the fortune of going. Now, the one thing I am worried about we're going to Waco, Texas to see it in the Path of Totality, is the cloud cover. We did, when I was a kid, actually get to go to France, very special trip. Wow. And we get all the way to Metz, out in the middle of France, and it gets rained out. And so we didn't actually see it. So hopefully that doesn't happen this time and the cloud cover will clear and we'll be good.
We'll keep our fingers crossed for you. Yeah. Well, let's shift to what actually you were coming on to talk about today. And that is a recent LAist piece in which a listener wrote to you about her child going to Franklin Avenue Elementary School in LAUSD campus and concerned about whether the campus was earthquake safe for her child to attend. And you wrote about this and sort of how to get information. How tough is it to get information about a specific campus?
I mean, it's quite tough. So the reason why this question was prompted is because there's a list that is called like the AB 300 list. And so back in 1999, the California legislature passed Assembly Bill 300, and it directed the Department of General Services to put together a list of public school buildings that might not meet this major 1976 code overhaul. And in the end, more than 9,600 buildings across the state were identified for review. And then in LAUSD specifically, it was ultimately like 667 buildings. And I think there's over 13,000 total. And since then, since 1999, 34 buildings have been successfully retrofitted, 139 buildings are being evaluated currently, and 459 still need to go through the process. So that list there was our starting point. And but when it came to finding information about a particular building, it was very difficult.
Well, there's no posting of like engineering reports on schools or anything like that that would speak to the specific structural vulnerabilities?
Yeah. So I guess theoretically, so back up for a second. So let's say you do have so people, by the way, can go to LAist.com if they're worried about their particular campus. We have a link to the list that people can go check out. Even if a building is on the list, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's dangerous. And that's what a couple structural engineers who have worked on these projects told me. The problem becomes when you want to know about a specific building, it's really complicated and tough to tell how a building, even if it's 100 years old, is going to perform in a quake. And so not only do you need on-the-ground structural assessment, you need some level of modeling for various quake scenarios. And then you also need to know like to what extent a building needs to be retrofitted. And so there are certain buildings like brick buildings that are just known to fail. They're really dangerous. LAUSD did tell us, and you know, I reached out to ask them. They did tell us that they have demolished or retrofitted all of the brick buildings, as well as a couple other types of buildings that are the riskiest. So, but again, it's a big question mark around any particular building.
Yeah, it's so interesting when you grow up in LA and you go to schools, you kind of learn their earthquake history. My elementary school in Inglewood, which is still open, Centinella Elementary, had been badly damaged in the 1933 Long Beach earthquake. So when I went there in the late 60s, it had been essentially rebuilt and added on to because of the damage from the Long Beach earthquake. Then when I was in junior high school and we'd moved to Hollywood at LeConte Junior High, they had to tear down the cafeteria because it was an unreinforced building. And so we went to school amid the rubble of the cafeterias being torn down as we went to school with all the material. A whole different time, you know, without protections. And the debris would catch fire and the like. But that's another story. Anyway.
Well, the Long Beach quake changed everything. So that's where this AB 300, list eventually, what it references is quite often that. So in 1933, I believe 70 schools were damaged or destroyed in the Long Beach quake. And luckily, kids weren't in school at the time. So it wasn't, I mean, the reality is there could have been quite a few deaths. And so after that, the Field Act was passed, which set strict building requirements for schools, or stricter ones than were previously in place. And since then, what I will say is that, and what is pointed out, is that no school buildings in California have collapsed since Long Beach. But, as someone with kids in LAUSD school, it's up to every person's, I guess, discretion. The sad part is that you can't really, without that report and without a specific detailing by LAUSD or the structural agency the company that's dealing with it, it's tough to tell how any one building will do. And they were not very transparent with me when I reached out about the entire process, which was a bummer.
Jacob, one of the points that you make is that schools should have earthquake plans, how to deal with an earthquake during school hours. What's the best way to get that information of what the plan is?
Yeah. So, even if you could read a structural report, or if you got one, you might not be able to read it. I know I don't necessarily understand them. And so there are some things that you can do to double check to make sure there are other earthquake, safety things in place. So you should definitely ask your school if you're concerned about this. What are the school's earthquake plans? Can you see them? It should, I believe, have a folder in the front office or a binder that, they should be able to detail it for you. What sorts of supplies they have, where are they available? When are they updated? What sort of precautions are they taking in terms of strapping down heavy items in the classroom? When I went into tour classrooms for my kid, I was kind of eyeing hey, do they have any gigantic cabinets precariously perched on top of one another that aren't strapped down? And then also you want to know, where are you able to pick up your kids after an earthquake? If you can't get to your kids for a day or 6 hours, what happens? And is there anything else you could do to prepare your child in anticipation of a disaster? Maybe you send them with, there are some bars in their backpack, food bars or something like that. They should have an emergency card and a way to get a hold of you, with all the information on it and stuff, so that people know what to do.
Jacob, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this piece that was really prompted by LAist reader and listener. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. And thanks to the listener for reaching out. We're always around to talk to people about their questions about the city.
Yeah. Thank you, Connie. We appreciate it. That's Jacob Margolis, yep. LAist science reporter. His piece, "Is My Kid's LAUSD Campus Safe from Earthquakes?" Coming up, we're going to be talking with Dr. Lucy Jones for our Southern California History segment we do every Monday. We'll talk with Lucy about the ways in which our engineering knowledge of how to make buildings safer for quakes, how that's evolved over the years. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3, and every Monday it's Southern California History, a time for us to take a different part of SoCal history. And given our science reporter Jacob Margolis's answer to a listener about whether her child's school in LA Unified is earthquake safe, we invited Dr. Lucy Jones, founder of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. She's the author of The Big Ones, research associate of the Caltech Seismological Laboratory, seismologist. Dr. Lucy Jones, good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Oh, thank you for having me, Larry.
Let's talk, first of all, about how significant the 1933 Long Beach earthquake was for our understanding of how buildings perform in quakes and how they needed to be re-engineered.
Well, I think the big thing about the 33 Long Beach earthquake is it was the first time we really took action. There had been a 1925 Santa Barbara earthquake where we saw a lot of damage to brick buildings, and then it happened all over again in 33. And two big things came out of it. One is the first time we ever had seismic provisions in a building code. 1935 building code said you couldn't build with just brick in a seismically active area, and California adopted that definition. But the other thing that happened is that a lot of the brick buildings that were destroyed in the 33 earthquake were schools. Nobody was injured because it was 6 o'clock at night and nobody was in the schools, but it caused a huge panic. And actually, literally 1 month after the earthquake, on April 10th, 1933, we passed the Field Act, which mandated that the construction of public schools would fall under state supervision, the Division of State Architect, and the plans had to be reviewed and the whole building process had to be inspected. There's also some change. There were some building code issues that now are not significant, but that continuous inspection and plan approval are really important for making our schools safer.
Then there's certain types of reinforcements required. Then how did subsequent earthquakes like Sylmar, Loma Prieta, and Northridge further refine? Did they add additional requirements?
To the building code, very much so. Every big earthquake led to a big change in the general building code. So just know that if your building is built to a code before the 1976 code, it almost certainly can be retrofitted to be stronger. It's not as good as it could be. And then the 97 code that included changes from Northridge are another big step forward. On schools, they didn't make as much of a difference because they'd already required them to just use really solid designs. The 76 code, yes, there are something called non-ductile reinforced concrete buildings that have been used for schools. And if it's the school was built before, say, 1980, and to the previous codes, there's still some things that can be done. But I think the other one for schools, a big one was the 1952 earthquake. So we put in the Field Act and schools were built better. In the 52 Kern County earthquake, 7.5, a lot of schools were damaged because they were built before the Field Act was in place. And that triggered a retrofitting requirement for public schools. So the late 50s and early 60s saw the school buildings that were built before 33 being retrofitted, made them much stronger than they were, clearly not up to the standards of a modern code.
And what are some of the ways they did that? Did they introduce steel, or what were the things to make it stronger at that point?
In the 50s, this was mostly dealing with buildings that were essentially brick buildings. And so frames were put in there. The big thing with a brick building is that the when you shake it, the mortar dissolves, the walls come down. If those walls are holding up the roof, then the roof comes down, and that's when you start crushing people and killing people. So the big thing was putting in some sort of framework of steel or wood. I mean, wood's a wonderful material for earthquake safety, to hold up the roof. These non-ductile concrete buildings, the big issue was the way the walls were connected to each other. And in some of the designs, the corners would start to come apart under earthquake shaking. And that then, again, allows the roof to collapse. And of course, concrete's very heavy and you see a lot of death there. And there was a law passed, well, the state in the early noughts passed a law. They had the Division of State Architect review all non-ductile concrete public school buildings and compile a list of the ones that potentially needed retrofitting. But the law didn't allow them to make the list public. That they would notify the school districts that they had the list and the school district could ask for it. I will say LA Unified was one of the very few districts early on that asked for that list and really worked to deal with it. LA Unified has been one of the most proactive of all of the state school districts in dealing with the seismic issues. Maybe a decade later, finally, the list was made public, but it still was up to the individual district to take action and retrofit from those.
We're talking with Dr. Lucy Jones, seismologist and founder of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. It's our Monday Southern California History segment of Air Talk, and we're talking about the retrofitting requirement for buildings vulnerable to earthquakes. Now, you, of course, were the point person for the city of Los Angeles's review of not just schools, but other buildings, commercial and residential, that were particularly vulnerable. Where did the implementation of the plan that you and others who served with you in this project, what you came up with?
That is moving forward. All of the building retrofit part of resilience by design, the LA plan, moved forward. The mandatory retrofit laws were passed by the city of Los Angeles in 2015. Most of what's called soft first story buildings have been completed their retrofit. The non-ductile concrete buildings had 25 years to complete the process. So only a few have been completed at this point, but a lot of them are starting the process of getting underway on getting that done. So Los Angeles has followed through with that because they passed the laws and then it has to happen. I want to make a point though that LA City has no authority about schools. That's what happened with the Field Act, is the authority for how schools would be built fell under the state, and it was not up to local jurisdictions. And that's really important because the state enforced the inspection requirements. And our biggest problem with buildings is not how, the design, it's usually how they're actually built and that they're, whether or not they were built as required.
Lucy, thank you as always for being with us and talking about this challenge and areas where we've had successes with retrofitting against earthquakes. We appreciate it very much.
Oh, thank you for having me, Larry. I always enjoy talking about this stuff.
I bet. And it's so important to you, and you've got the expertise for years in the field. Dr. Lucy Jones joining us of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. She's founder of it, seismologist, the author of The Big Ones, and research associate at the Caltech Seismo Laboratory. It's Air Talk on LA. It's 89.3.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubrias, The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We come your way from the Moen Broadcast Center. And if you're a golfer and you live in or near the city of Los Angeles, you probably know the bargain it is to golf at LA City's public courses. But the flip side of that is, because they're a great bargain and many of the courses are beautiful, very difficult to get a tee time. And according to many golfers, that's become even more challenging because of brokers who are snatching up tee times with online bookings and then reselling them at a higher price and pocketing the profits. Joining us is the chair of the Golf Advisory Committee for the City of Los Angeles, Kevin Fitzgerald. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the program.
When did the allegations that there were brokers buying up tee times, when did that first start?
Well, I think the story really went viral the last few weeks. So there was some interest in the topic ever since the pandemic. It's always been very difficult to get a tee time on the LA City golf courses. We've seen an incredible boost in participation since the pandemic. The game essentially exploded. It was already in a position where we saw an increase in the total number of golfers for several years prior to 2020. And then coming out of the pandemic, the speculation about brokers and bots has only become more and more robust. It's something that the city's staff has been monitoring with their third-party broker that manages the online reservation platform. And really in the last few weeks, it became a big story when an Instagram influencer found what was really, for me, the first time I saw some clear evidence that this broker activity might be going on.
And explain to us how it works. So how, first of all, how is it suspected the broker is able to make the reservation? Is it that they're just do it like any other LA resident, or do they buy the annual pass, which gives priority for reserving? How do we think the brokers are doing it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know that we have all of the answers at this point. You know, to take one step back, as you mentioned at the start of this segment, the National Golf Foundation considers the Los Angeles region to be the worst place in the United States to be a golfer. So there are more golfers chasing fewer holes here than anywhere else. And then when you couple that with the fact that the Recreation and Parks Department is, you know, considers affordable and accessible golf to be paramount, that's the mission of the golf division, is to provide not only a great experience, but an affordable and accessible one. So the golf courses are set at greens fee. That's essentially the cost to access the golf course. Those fees are set very low compared with what the market rate.
Is it $25 or what?
It ranges based on the day of the week, the time of the day, but from about $14 to the premium early morning weekend rate at a couple of the premier golf courses, about 55, so
still
14 to 55, yeah. Average around $35.
Yeah.
So we have this issue where the golf courses are being provided well below market rates. Now, again, that's intentional. That's we view that as positive, because we want, it's always been, not only the golfers want to make sure that everyone who is interested in participating will have a chance to play, but certainly the mission of the golf division.
So how are golfers who find the tee times are sold out on the city's website, how are they learning about the brokers that are offering resale of those tee times?
Yeah, so I think we've heard speculation for some time, but for the first time a couple weeks ago, we saw this post that clearly showed that there were tee times available at a premium. So essentially, you have to pay a broker to get a tee time. Now, the sad part of that is that those dollars are become a de facto greens fee increase, and also those dollars are not going back into, say, capital reinvestment or the cost of providing the service.
Yeah,
the
you might
place.
As well have the city raise its greens fees and collect that to go for the benefit of the courses.
Well, let's not go that far.
No, but I mean, that would be better than it going in a broker's pocket.
Absolutely,
I assume.
Absolutely.
But do we know how they're finding out about the brokers? Is this word of mouth?
Exactly. I mean, I think in the last couple of years, I've heard the following. Well, I heard that a friend of mine reserved this tee time through this person that we know, and I would always ask, well, you know, show me something. I'd be interested to see. It was always hearsay. And really what changed a couple weeks ago is that, you know, I saw some evidence, and I think, you know, through the story going viral, we've seen this app, and I'm sure if there's one, it could well be that there are others that you know, showed that for a premium, you could access a tee time by purchasing the entire time through this broker service.
Is it illegal to resell the tee time reservation?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So it's certainly not in line with the city's code of conduct. I think this is not an uncommon tale when you compare it with something like trying to buy a Beyonce or Taylor Swift concert ticket. I think what's different here is that this is part of the park system, and there are some ideas, some are policy ideas, and some are enhanced technological mechanisms that could help combat this problem. I think that as far as the legality, I'm not sure about that, because you haven't at this point paid for the tee time. You've reserved a tee time. Now, some of the ideas that were discussed at the meeting last week had to do with perhaps some element of a down payment that would be non-refundable. That might cut into, you know, we saw everything from $40 per tee time up to possibly $30, $40 per player. That's a significant increase over the rate. However, perhaps that would be an example of a policy change that could impact the market for brokers. Other ideas include, currently, if you cancel a time, it becomes available automatically. So something else that was discussed, could you stagger the release of tee times that are canceled? That could help. So unfortunately, when you have just brute force and an incredible amount of demand for each tee time, I think there will be ideas that help. I don't know that anything, there's not a silver bullet as I see it in the short run, but there are different ideas that could help mitigate the problem.
What about having the golfer who makes the reservation have to show government-issued ID upon arrival at the golf course to tee off?
They actually have to do that now.
So how does that happen then? If the original reservation on the city's website is under a particular name, how does that happen if it's resold?
Well, so a good example would be the broker is able to book the time, and then when the traffic is very low, currently the system opens 9 days in advance at 6 a.m. Traffic is down at, say, 3 in the morning. So the broker is able to secure times. If you then contact the broker, they put your information in the middle of the night. They cancel the time quickly and then rebook it with your name. So it becomes very difficult to mitigate the problem because this isn't, it sounds as though, for the most part, it isn't technological. It's just brute force.
Yeah.
And that's
someone in the
much
middle of the night willing to
manage.
Do it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely.
So a staggered re-release of those times would be another potential mitigation measure.
Because they wouldn't be standing by to put in the buyer's name as soon as it's released, because they wouldn't know when it's going to be re-released that open time.
Correct. And I think it's also important to note that there are a few other things that have changed in the last couple of years. One, the golf courses have retained a 10-minute tee time interval. So at one point, you had a shorter interval in between groups. Part of the COVID the change in policy coming out of COVID was that it was a far better experience to have a 10-minute tee interval and a maximum of four golfers per group as opposed to five. So when you think about it in terms of what change that makes, well, there's less capacity in those early hours, the most sought after hours of the day. And we've seen the rounds increase and continue to stay at an all-time record high. However, when you're looking for, say, a time from 7 a.m. until noon, really the 5 hours that are most highly sought after, there's less capacity in that range. However, the utilization is essentially 100%.
We're talking with Kevin Fitzgerald, chair of the Golf Advisory Committee for the City of Los Angeles. My understanding is that Los Angeles's Korean Americans are particularly enthusiastic golfers, and so I assume this has hit that community particularly hard.
Yeah, and I think that some of the stories have been particularly concerning. I certainly don't want to scapegoat one segment of the golfing public. I think that it just so happens that the first broker app that came to light broadly, that there was a connection to a particular person and representative of a particular group. But I don't want to go down that road at all, because I think it's just an incredible amount of demand for available tee times.
Well, I just meant that it's a community that particularly embraces golfing, and so this inability to get tee times except by broker would hit that community particularly hard. Thank you so much, Kevin. Appreciate you coming in and talking about it. Hope you're able to find a solution to keep these affordable tee times and to keep them available for people without having to pay a surcharge. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's Kevin Fitzgerald, chair of the Golf Advisory Committee for the City of Los Angeles. It's Air Talk.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubría's The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us today. I'm joined by NPR's national political correspondent and co-host of the NPR Politics Podcast, Sarah McCammon. She was born into and raised in a devout evangelical Christian family, regular church attendee, a product of Christian schools, and someone who's very devout as a young person, but later in her life came to question some of the tenets of the faith with which she was raised. And she's author of the new book, The Exvangelicals: Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah McCammon, so good to have you with us today on Air Talk.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about, first of all, what that childhood experience was like. Many of us are very familiar with what a conservative, evangelical Christian upbringing can be like. Some are homeschooled. Some are only in Christian education. What specifically was yours like?
Well, my whole world was pretty much evangelical Christians and Christian school and Christian media. We had TV, radio, books, magazines, everything you can think of pretty much supplied by evangelical Christian publishers and broadcasters. I spent my weekdays at a Christian school surrounded by other kids who believed what we believed. And I really knew very few people who didn't share our belief system. And, you know, I wrote this book because when I covered the 2016 campaign, that was kind of a time when the white evangelical movement was very much in the spotlight, particularly in the Republican primary. And I found myself writing about themes, and lots of journalists were, that really intersected with my own childhood. And I spent a number of years after that thinking about what I wanted to say about it. And this book is really the product of that kind of unexpected intersection of my professional and personal lives.
You know, when I think of evangelicalism, and I come from that background, and I'm a Christian today. I think of it as sort of distinct camps, that there is a fundamentalist camp which believes in biblical literalism, that doesn't accept evolution, that has, you know, very, very proscribed sorts of views of how the Bible should be read and the strictures that should exist on people's personal lives. But also I think of a wider range of evangelicalism, which is intellectually curious and believes in science and is supportive of people of all kinds of backgrounds. And I wonder for yourself, how do you draw that distinction? Because it sounds like you came up in a pretty fundamentalist background.
Well, there is a spectrum, that's for sure. And, you know, scholars and academics debate where the line is between fundamentalism and evangelicalism. But what I found in my own experience, you know, spending time in, you know, both a Christian, you know, pretty fundamentalist Christian school, but where kids came from all kinds of evangelical backgrounds. You know, there were kids from Church of the Nazarene, there were kids from non-denominational churches, there were kids from Baptist churches, Bible churches. You know, we all kind of intermingled. And it was really that way at my evangelical college, which was an evangelical free college, the Evangelical Free Church. People came from a number of different, you know, theologically conservative Protestant backgrounds and would intermarry and would consume much of the same evangelical media and books. And you know, there was sort of a subculture that we all kind of came up in. You know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, most of the people in my world, maybe that's because I'm from the Midwest and I think the South would have been much this way. Most of the people I knew believed in, did not believe in evolution, believed maybe they would talk about something called intelligent design, the sort of idea that, you know, God would guide science, but ultimately was kind of a thinly veiled creationist idea. most people, everyone I grew up around, my church, my Christian school, my college, was deep in purity culture, this idea that there should be absolutely no sex before marriage. And so while there is a spectrum, I think for the way a lot of people experience it is that those sort of subsects and intersecting, kind of cross-pollinating streams of thought within evangelicalism and fundamentalism, they interact with each other and commingle in the real world.
Sarah, describe for us what it was like, your relationship or lack of relationship to popular culture, because going to a school like this, having media tightly controlled in the home, even the books that you're reading, did you feel a disconnect between what you were experiencing in the larger world, or were you largely unaware of the larger popular culture world beyond what you were raised with?
You know, we were often told that we needed to be, this was from the Bible, in the world, but not of the world. And so that meant that access to sort of pop culture and things outside of, you know, a few, outside of, you know, our Christian school textbooks and our magazines from Focus on the Family, organizations like that, were not prohibited, but were kind of carefully curated. So, and there, again, you know, with evangelical kids, there's a spectrum here. You know, some are, I had friends that went to a lot more movies than I was allowed to go to. We knew people who were more strict, but you know, my parents were very careful about what we were exposed to. There was this idea that you have to train children very carefully to you know, cultivate a Christian worldview, as it was put.
You found yourself distanced from your grandfather, who's a gay physician. Fortunately, you were able to connect with him at a deeper level later in his life. But how did you deal with that disconnect from, you know, what you were told about your grandfather and his lack of faith, what that would mean versus your perception of him?
You know, I really began one of the first chapters in the book by talking about my family's kitchen table, our dinner table, where almost every day we would sit down and pray a prayer for my grandfather's soul. We, you know, he was one of the very few people in my life that I was close to at all who was not part of our evangelical community. And that was a source of a lot of mystery for me and confusion and concern for our family. And as you mentioned, as I got a little bit older and I described sort of how this unfolded in the book in a way that was, you know, quite difficult and complicated for my family, I discovered that his sexuality had been kept a secret from me, that he had come out as a gay man after my grandmother had died. And that because of that, you know, there had been a real distance between my family and him and a division in our family. Because my parents believed that his, you know, lifestyle was sinful and that we shouldn't be exposed to it. So we saw him, you know, on holidays, and we saw him occasionally at other times, but we really didn't have the kind of closeness that many grandparents have with their grandchildren, unfortunately. But his existence, you know, as somebody who was different, really forced me to think about difference. And I talk in the book about several encounters I have as I'm growing up, you know, making a Muslim friend, meeting somebody who goes to, you know, who doesn't go to church really very often, and how I think about, you know, just the cognitive dissonance that those human connections, you know, force me to think about and try to make sense of, you know, my beliefs in contrast with other people's beliefs.
And share with us, in fact, that conversation. I believe you were a high school student and you went to D.C. for a special program, and you had one of the colleague students that was there who's Muslim who approached you. What did that student ask, and how did it set your mind to thinking about the notion of salvation and hell?
Yeah, when I was a junior in high school, I went to Washington as a Senate page. So if you've watched C-SPAN, you see those teenagers in those blue suits walking around with things or sitting on the steps leading up to the Senate rostrum. Those are the pages who kind of do the busy work for the senators. And I did that my junior year of high school for a semester. And it was really the first time. I have to give my parents a lot of credit for letting me go, because I'd been so sheltered up to that point. But it was the first time I'd really been around people who were different at any, you know, for any extended period of time, you know, and there were Mormon kids and a Muslim student and Episcopalians and all kinds of, I'm sure there were some who weren't religious. And so it was really eye-opening to not be surrounded by you know, this evangelical bubble I'd grown up in. And yes, I had a, you know, a good friend that whose parents had immigrated from Iran, I think before he was born. And, you know, we got to know each other. He told me his family's story. You know, they'd been through a lot at that time with trying to having to uproot and get started again in the United States. And he was just somebody I really liked and really cared about. And the first person I'd, probably one of the first people I'd really gotten to know from a totally different faith background. And one day we were sitting on those steps leading up to the Senate rostrum, just talking while we waited for something to happen. And somehow our religious backgrounds came up. And he just asked me point blank, you know, do you think I'm going to hell because I'm a Muslim, because I'm not a Christian? And, you know, everything I'd been told was that I should say yes, but it just didn't feel right to me to say that. And I thought about it, and I think I said, I think I just kind of demurred. I said, I don't know. I guess that's between you and God. But it stuck with me. You know, that memory stuck with me because it really forced me to ask myself what I did believe about people who were different from me.
We're talking with Sarah McCammon, NPR national political correspondent and author of The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving, the White Evangelical Church. It's a trend that we've seen grow in recent years. There was, of course, a boom period for the White Evangelical Church going back to the 1970s and continuing for decades after. Since, there's been a considerable leaving of evangelicals, as well as an even greater loss from mainline Protestant denominational churches. There has been a rise here in Southern California, particularly of Latinos in evangelical churches. We'll talk about that when we continue with Sarah. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Coming up next hour on our Air Talk Overtime, an extended edition of the program, Patrick Stewart. You know him as Captain Jean-Luc Picard, longtime listener to Air Talk, and LAist joins me. That's next hour, right here on Air Talk. Right now, we're also hearing from a very familiar voice to NPR listeners, Sarah McCammon, national political correspondent for NPR and co-host of the NPR Politics Podcast. Her book, which is a very personal one about her experience of leaving the evangelical church in which she was raised, is titled The Exvangelicals. Sarah, please quantify for us our understanding of how much this leaving of the evangelical church has taken place over the past decade.
Well, it's happening in the larger context of religious decline across the board, particularly among white Christianity, evangelicalism is just a subset, but it's a particularly influential one, right? It has an outsized influence in American politics because of its dominance in the Republican Party, and it's the world that I came from. So that's why I focused my book on ex-evangelicals. Also, there happens to be a particularly vocal conversation playing out in a lot of social media spaces and in podcasts and so forth right now among former evangelicals who are, many of whom are very publicly rethinking their faith at this kind of divisive political moment in our country. But what I can say about the data that we have so far is that at the sort of peak of the evangelical movement, some nearly one in four Americans were white evangelicals, larger, more like 30% if you include evangelicals of color. And that happened right around the early 90s. There was some up and down. And then around the mid-2000s, the evangelical movement hit its peak again. And according to data from the Public Religion Research Institute, it's been falling ever since, down to about 14% of the population today. So that's about a 10-point drop over that 20-year period. That is, you know, a marked shift, and it's, again, at a time when the country as a whole is becoming more diverse and also, separately, less religious. So there are a lot of things happening at once, and it's hard to say how much of that is demographic change and how much is people leaving the church. But I talk to a lot of people who are, once again, you know, finding each other in social media spaces, in podcasts. There are a lot of books out this year about this experience called deconstruction. It's sort of a language that's developed around this experience online the last few years. And, you know, what's clearly happening is that American Christianity is undergoing a time of real transition. there's new data out from the Pew Center a couple months ago that suggests that there are now more people who call themselves nothing at all than are white evangelicals, and that's a big change.
Rise of the nuns, as it's N-O-N-E-S, as it's sometimes talked about. Sarah, how did you deal with the feelings of loss of the community, leaving evangelical Christianity, the disapproval of your family members concerned about your spiritual health and you know what your future would hold? How did you deal with all this upheaval in your life when you made this move?
Well, this is something that when I first heard the word ex-evangelical as kind of a hashtag and a new, like I said, a new language around this experience, it really jumped out at me. I was doing a story in 2016 talking to evangelical women who were struggling with the aftermath of the release of the Access Hollywood video and the evangelical alignment with Donald Trump. And some of them were saying that they just didn't feel comfortable with the evangelical label anymore because it was so aligned with a particular political project. And, you know, I had had my own shift away from evangelicalism years before that for a whole lot of reasons, one of them being the way that the church talked about gay people, including people like my grandfather, who we talked about earlier. And I just recognized in that label this sense of I was once part of something and now I am not. And I think for a lot of people who've had to rethink their faith, whether that's former evangelicals or people from other faith backgrounds, that can be a really painful and challenging process, particularly if you're in what psychologists and sociologists call high-control religious communities, where the boundaries are pretty strictly policed and enforced, and it's very easy to fall outside the lines if you maybe rethink parts of your faith or you have a more tenuous relationship to it than you once did. And so it's a common theme in these ex-evangelical and deconstruction circles, people who are going, you know, I really feel connected to my church or my family, but parts of what I was taught to believe, parts of what they believe don't align with who I am. And that's created a real cognitive dissonance, a real source of tension. For me and for many others, I think it often sort of elicits some really painful conversations and sometimes some shuts down conversations because people find that there are just certain areas that can't be discussed with family. And I think this is probably something a lot of people will recognize in an increasingly divided country that we live in, you know, regardless of what your religious background is. And it's really challenging, and people navigate it in lots of different ways. You know, some of the people I interviewed for the ex-evangelicals have had to just be very clear with their family members about, you know, there are just certain things we don't talk about. Which, you know, may preserve the relationship, but it also creates kind of a distance at the same time. Well, but for a lot of people, I think that's better than not having a relationship at all.
And so painful, because for family members who believe that their child or sibling are going to hell because they don't hold to the same view, you know, Christian views that they did earlier in life, it's a very, very painful thing. How do you navigate this with your family?
You know, I talk about this in my book, and I'm honestly more comfortable with what I said in my book than having a long conversation about it. And I hope people will read The Ex-Evangelicals, because I do describe some of those interactions there. But in short, it's been challenging. You know, I try to be kind, but I also try to be authentic to who I am. And that has elicited some, as I said, very challenging conversations at times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a tough line to walk when you are at a very different place from someone else. Or, you know, for example, when part of my family accepted my gay grandfather and others did not, you know, that required sort of, for me, taking a clear stand about how I felt and my support for him. And that cost me some relationships in my family. And I think, again, that this is something that anybody who comes from an environment where there is political or religious division is something that they'll recognize.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, because you have such a unique position to comment on this, having grown up in this culture, but covered the Trump campaign with so many stops along the way and flying on the plane with media as they covered his campaign. Can you explain what for so many Americans I think is a difficult thing? How evangelicals, with their particular view of morality, were able to get comfortable with the morality of Donald Trump. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, there's been a lot of ink spilled about this, and I often say if I had a, I wish I had a dollar for every time I've been asked this question. The short answer is that, you know, there's this, I think there's this misconception that, that Trump hijacked the evangelical movement, and I'm not sure that's quite accurate. I think, you know, I think I really lay out in my book how the groundwork had been laid long ago, you know, with the rise of the moral majority, with the creation of kind of this, in many ways, parallel information universe that raised a whole generation of evangelical Christians to think and talk a certain way and reinforced those ideas. And, you know, some of the ideas that one of the things I did for this book is I purchased some of my old Christian school textbooks and went back to some of the things that we were being taught in that environment. And, you know, they painted a very glowing picture of literally a Christian nation. You know, some of the same themes we see on the rise today in the religious right, Christian nationalist themes. And so for, you know, Donald Trump, I think, represented for many evangelicals someone who would be a champion for their causes, for their policy goals, and for their movement. You know, he promised that he would support Christians, that he would protect Christians. He makes statements like this a lot today. And they ultimately were willing to overlook his moral failings in order to achieve that. I would often hear in 2016 that there was a binary choice between, you know, Clinton and Trump, and that may have been the case. But we saw in 2024 in the Republican primary, Republican voters, including evangelical voters, had many other options besides Trump. And based on exit polling, white evangelicals were a major factor in making Trump the presumptive nominee once again. So they seem to have overcome whatever misgivings they may have had, at least a majority of white evangelicals.
Sarah, thank you so much for coming on today and talking about your new book, The Ex-Evangelicals. We appreciate it very much and always appreciate your reporting for NPR as well.
Thanks for your time.
The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living and Leaving the White Evangelical Church, and our Julia Paskin, LAist host, will be talking with Sarah for a live event here at our Crawford Family Forum coming up on April 25th at 7 p.m. Information and reservations available at laist.com/events.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at laist.com/sweeps.